Blog Talk Radio.
A long time ago, on a gloomy, wet Cleveland spring night, two men stand alone amidst the late night drizzle. Their voices echo across the vacant station parking lot as they debate the merits of the great American radio show that have been missing for far too long. On that night, an idea was born. That idea became the FDH Lounge. Welcome to the FDH Lounge.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to mini episode number 142 of the FDH Lounge. We have a very, very special one for you here today. This is FDH managing partner Rick Morris, and we've got one of the true legends of professional wrestling coming on the program with us here today. If you grew up watching Georgia Championship Wrestling back in the day, World Championship Wrestling as it became in the mid-80s, there was one guy in particular out of the bunch. A lot of people loved cheering for Ric Flair, almost sort of despite themselves and the fact that you weren't necessarily supposed to. A lot of folks cheered for the Andersons, the Minnesota Wrecking Crew. Even Lex Luger, when he became a bad guy in there, still had some people who followed him over. But there was one guy in particular out of that bunch. And I know that for those of us who watched the show back in the day, all the time, there was one guy that just always really, really seemed to get your ire and out of the Four Horsemen. And it's very similar, I would say, to when we had Jim Cornette on the show. We were fortunate to have him on. And for a show that's not explicitly about pro wrestling, we are the show where nothing is off topic, but we've probably been fortunate to be able to do more things with people in wrestling than any show that's not an explicitly branded wrestling show. It's been our pleasure to talk to a number of people. I remember saying to Jim Cornette when he was on that I used to yell for Precious Paul to take his head off at ringside, and came to see subsequently what a sign that was of how tremendous he was at doing his job. And certainly the same could be said for the gentleman that we have joining us here today, a second-generation pro wrestler, son of Joe Blanchard. He's one of the greats of the 1980s, and he's doing even greater deeds, I would say, today. Whereas, as much as we are tremendous admirers of his professional track record, I would say we are even greater admirers of what he is doing personally. And we're looking forward to really talking about all facets of his life. He has some great stories to tell. He's moving more aggressively now into social media. He just got on Twitter. He's been very aggressive with his Facebook page as far as communicating to his public and reaching out to his fans and connecting to folks. And we are very, very happy that he has chosen this new media venue as one place to continue to, again, spread his message, talk about his life story, and really get into anything and everything that his fans want to know about. So it's a pleasure to welcome to the show one of the original Four Horsemen, and as of this past March, a WWE Hall of Famer, the legendary Tully Blanchard. Tully, welcome to the FDH Lounge, sir. How are you tonight? Tully?
Rick, are you there?
Yes, sir. How are you today, sir?
I am doing great. It's great to be with you guys today.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to have you on the program. Looking forward to really talking about all facets of your story. I guess starting chronologically here, your early days in Southwest Championship Wrestling, getting a chance to learn the business under the watchful eye of your dad and some of the great talent that was down there at the time, the likes of Gino Hernandez, growing into the business with him and some of the other guys. How did that really affect you for the rest of your career, getting your formative experiences there?
Well, you've got to learn what is good, what is great. There were a lot of good guys back in those days, but they didn't sell tickets. There were a few guys that sold tickets in certain areas, and there were some guys that sold tickets every place they ever went. And those are the guys that you wanted to learn from. And I was very, very fortunate, and I've told this not very, very many times, but I refereed for 3 years when I was in college, and I refereed during the summer as my summer job. And refereeing, I got to be in the ring five times a night instead of one. And I got to watch the first match to the main event match. I got to watch the prelims up to the money matches. I got to be involved with angles and things that were going on and timing and everything and watching just unbelievable talented people. Wahoo McDaniels, Jose Lothario, and people like that, Neil Mascaris, that were just outstanding. And I learned a lot from that. And then when I started wrestling, I went to Georgia for a little bit. Then when I graduated from college, I went to Florida for 4 or 5 months. And then I went to Mid-Atlantic Championship Wrestling at the end of 1977 and stayed there for about 6 or 8 months. And I came back home. I learned everything you could learn about being a prelim guy. And then it was time for me to learn how to be a main event guy and sell tickets. And I did that when I came home, when I brought some of the different things that we were going to adjust, doing our TV show and doing some things here that I'd learned from the Eddie Grahams, and I learned from the Crockett's. And then you go into my Southwest years. I mean, I wrestled Wahoo just about every day for a year or two. I wrestled Bob Sweetan, who was a great performer. I wrestled Buddy Roberts, who was Dale Valentine. But the key was he had John Valentine sitting in the corner every night for a year critiquing me. And we'd go back in the dressing room, and John would critique everything you do. And there's nobody that could perform any better than Johnny Valentine in the history of wrestling. And to be a heel of that caliber, and when you've got that kind of tutelage going on, you've got to be a stark raving idiot not to learn something.
Well, I'll tell you what, Telly, just from listening to you there, it really is one of these things where you really get a firm grasp on how you developed the ring psychology that you did from everything that you said, from all the refereeing and everything and the wonderful personalities you got a chance to learn from. And one of the things that just pops into my head upon listening to that, Tully, is when we had J.J. Dillon on the show, him talking about his own love of Johnny Valentine and how that helped motivate him to get in the business in the first place. I can imagine back in the Four Horsemen days, you guys must have had a lot of fun telling Johnny Valentine stories.
Well, there were, we were a little more self-centered than that, but everybody had the respect for John Valentine in the ring, you know. And when I first went to Florida, and I don't know why Eddie Graham took a liking to me, but I'd wrestle at night, and then I'd go to the, I had to be at the office at 9 o'clock in the morning, and I'd go through a 3-hour workout with Eddie, and very few people in the wrestling business were any better ring psychologist than Eddie Graham. And I was very fortunate that he liked me and took an interest in me.
I've read about that from other folks as well, about Eddie Graham and what he had to teach in terms of ring psychology and how he could really help make a match believable. And that's amazing, all the great people that you got a chance to learn from. Of course, these were all experiences that you took forward with you. And of course, 1985, looking to be the really big breakout year of your career, and what an incredible time that was leading up to the formation of the Four Horsemen. I mean, your match against Magnum TA at Starrcade, I mean, to this day, you can go on message boards anywhere, and somebody will hold that up as the example of almost like the perfect pro wrestling grudge match, the way that it came off. And, you know, what was it like for you in that time there when things were really just starting to explode for you personally as the Horsemen were being formed?
Well, the when I went in February of 84 and I moved to go to work for Crockett, I'd already been there and was just a prelim babyface guy. And in 77, so now I come back 7 years later, I was ready to be one of the stars, and their business was in transition. They weren't really doing that well. And when I came in, we started kind of moving the business forward. And Wahoo and I wrestled Flair and Mulligan in Greensboro. And it was the first sellout that we had there when I had gone back to work there. And so that was in August of 84. And then we built up to when I wrestled Steamboat and Dusty wrestled Flair at Starrcade that year. And the Steamboat thing was great. And then the momentum of the company and the people that were making that momentum happen moved on into 85. And, Magnum TA came in, the Rock and Roll Express came in, the Midnight Express came in. And so you had a great quality of talent coming in. Ivan Koloff, superstar Billy Graham was there at the time, and I can't remember everybody, but the Garvins came in, and so you had a great, great stable of talent that the ship had already caught the wave and it was riding the wave. And then you add the feuds like the Magnum feud and the Baby Doll thing. Oh my gosh, that had never been really done the way we did it with the Perfect 10 contest and that kind of stuff, and that was it was different than me coming in trying to have a female valet. It was me already there. I was already the TV champion. I was already established, and we had a different perspective, so it gave it a different look. And then so that thing was fantastic. And then when she we did the thing with Magnum, and I beat him for the, when she handed me the roll of quarters, came in dressed up like a policeman in the Charlotte Coliseum, you could have heard a pin drop when the referee counted three and I got out of there with the title. And that set that whole year up for he and I, and then going into to Starrcade with the I Quit match inside the cage. And then, it's just, it's much easier to keep a ship moving than it is to start a ship. And,
well, that's a magical time, Tully, no question about it. I'm getting chills just listening and thinking back on what it was like at the time. And, I have to ask you, this is a point of personal privilege. I interject this question whenever I'm talking to anybody from the Crockett days, just because I'm always disturbed by some of this revisionism that I hear. The guy who was my favorite wrestler back in the day, hands of stone, Ron Garvin, and you guys really, collectively, I think it was clearly a team effort now if you understand the business looking back, but I mean, to me, a kid growing up in a blue-collar area, this guy was like the blue-collar Superman. We just couldn't wait to see him get his hands on Flair and you and anybody else. And does it disturb you now to kind of hear the revisionism in terms of, how'd this guy ever become an NWA world champion and what were they thinking? Because you guys really had done such a great job of building him up. Granted, his title reign wasn't booked very well, but that wasn't his fault. I just feel like it shortchanges, him and all of you guys who really helped to build him up and make him so credible to all of us.
Well, the thing that Ronnie was a great performer, okay? And that one summer, the Great American Bash on tour, I had more tape fist matches with him. I got the crap beat out of me. every stinking night. And and the thing that the NWA was oriented to was heel champions, not babyface champions.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So babyface champions never did have a good run. And so, when that gave ultimate credibility to Ronnie's place, career, everything, that they put the belt on him, even for however long it was. But you couldn't stay there because we needed heel champions,
mm-hmm.
Flair was just exceptional. And so, that's the only thing that you have any credibility. I mean, there are no credibility issues. I mean, he was a world champion. He's in the record books, never can be out. You know, I was never the world champion. I was tag team, television, you know, beat around it, but I was never the world's heavyweight champion. And it wouldn't, that wouldn't have been the right move because, you know, you can't be there with Flair. You know, I mean, we all had our roles with the Horsemen to play, and that was the role that I was in and he was in. And, you know, so I never even ever thought about that. I just thought about making sure that we sold out buildings. That was my job, to sell tickets. And all of us had that same demeanor, that our job was to sell tickets. And then when the people came to the arenas, we had to entertain them so they'd come back the next time. And we did that for 5 years, 4 years. And it was an exceptional time in professional wrestling that had never seen that until that time.
It really was. It was such a magical time. And in terms of the things that were going on then, I want to ask you something just to kind of pick your brain creatively, because I'm always just fascinated to hear, and especially guys like you that have such a good grasp of the psychology of it and of booking matters and laying out programs, something that kind of gets held up by a lot of people as an example of the death of a major market. You go back to Starrcade 87, and the match that you guys had with the Road Warriors there, which it seemed like might have been, to a lot of people, myself included, maybe the worst of both worlds, because the crowd was dying for the Road Warriors to get the belts. They were billed as the hometown boys. They didn't get them. But in the process, in order to try to appease the crowd, you and Arn didn't come out of it looking especially great, and it didn't seem to do a lot for you guys' credibility. Is that an example of really the worst of both worlds in a situation like that? There were a lot of quote-unquote dusty finishes back in the day, and I'm just curious for your thoughts. I'm not inviting you to bash any of the booking or anything, but just your thoughts on the successful booking of a promotion and how you should administer programs like that.
Well, you've got to know when you get into the end of the thing, you've got to know what you're going to do. You're either going to change the titles or you're going to do something different, you know, and the biggest problem is backing yourself into the corner. And the unfortunate thing is I was not in those meetings and I was not asked my opinion until you get there and it just, you go over it. Because JJ was our manager and you know, you got to have some of the insight, but JJ was very tight-lipped and he took care of his office job the way he was supposed to. And, you know, and business was very, very good, and it didn't keep us from selling out Chicago the next time we came back, and it didn't keep the Road Warriors from being, the monsters that they were. And, you know, but it was a little bit of a difficult situation that night or that afternoon, probably was not the best match that we'd ever had, but still, it was still a good match. I've seen it.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, I've watched it. It was a great, great match, Tully, no question about it. You know, and you look at what happened there and everything. Again, you guys had a tremendous run as World Tag Team Champions, and then when you ended up going to the WWF, as it was known at the time, of course, after a period of getting immersed there, becoming Tag Team Champions as well. But I'm just interested in terms of connecting the dots here, as I think our audience is. The issues that came up later on and some of the personal demons that you ended up battling, is it a good assumption for people that some of this might have started during the high-flying days of the Four Horsemen and when you guys were on top of the world and partying in every city? Were things starting to get a grip on you then, or were you largely in control of matters at that particular time?
In matters of?
Specifically substance abuse and anything else of that nature. Was everything pretty much in check with you at that point in time, or did things just materialize later down the road?
Oh, no. I was things had been out of control in my life before I ever went to to work for Crockett.
I
had a lot more control of my addiction at that time. And the things that transpired later, I mean, it was, you know, I never had missed a match and didn't come to work high or anything like that. I mean, my drug abuse was more of a social thing. It was because I was too lazy to think of good ways to talk to girls. You had cocaine in your pocket in the 80s. You didn't have to talk. And so, you know, that's kind of the way I approached it. It was just an easier way to go. And, you know, but and me leaving had nothing to do with my substance. It had [S2]
Right. [S1]
To do with the fact that I thought that I was being mistreated and Arn thought he was being mistreated. And, well, we all thought we were all being mistreated. It's just Flair was making a lot more money, so he put up with the mistreatment, and we weren't. And then they were signing contracts to guys that were not, in our opinion, as important to the company, and they treated us like we were, oh, we're going to do whatever they want. And, you know, you can only ride that horse so long before finally they either die or they leave.
Absolutely. And you guys went on and had a great run over in the WWF, again, as it was known at the time. And subsequent to that, again, you ended up getting out of the business, this being a period of time when you were when you ended up embracing the path of God. But I'm just curious, and again, you saying that, you know, you're painting a picture of being fairly functional over a period of time, which, again, I think squares with the recollections that anybody would have, because you were putting on great matches all throughout that. And you know, you can generally tell the guys that are really messed up when they go in the ring, and they don't tend to last for very long. But that period of time, then subsequent to that, after you embraced God and started going through that journey, has there been a time with where you've looked at the wrestling industry, and it's one of the most, probably the most unfortunate thing about it has been the trail of death over the last 25 years, all the fellows that dropped dead early due to drugs and everything like that. Anybody like a Road Warrior Hawk, a Kurt Hennig, anybody like that? Any thought as you're looking at those guys, you know, there but for the grace of God go I, or are you just firmly convinced that there was another purpose for you all along?
Well, I know that there was another purpose for me all along, but I could have easily gone the other. I mean, when you've got the drugs and alcohol running through your brain, you don't make conscious good decisions. And I made a lot of decisions that, oh my gosh, it was, you know, I mean, it could have easily been you know, me they found in some hotel room. And but, you know, I didn't. And I was very fortunate. But I was, you know, I was a little bit, and there again, I don't know what a lot of those guys' habits were. I know that they did stuff, but, you know, what they did, how much they did, I didn't know. I wasn't into the group thing. I was off doing my thing with hopefully some young lady. But anyway, it was, you know, that's ultimately what caused my downfall. The thing that is kind of amazing to me, how many people with the WWF have gone through substance abuse suspensions and still come right back to the wrestling business. I'm the only guy that at the peak of his career, the peak of his earning ability, that left the wrestling business and just stayed gone.
It really is an amazing story, and you know, just the path that you've been on ever since then. I mean, again, such an admirable one, I think we would say, just in trying to provide a good message for people. I know that A good part of what you've been working on has been prison ministry, and that leads me to a question. There's a gentleman I personally very much admire. I never got a chance to meet. I wonder, did your paths ever cross with Chuck Colson in the course of this?
I have met Chuck Colson. I worked for the company that Bill Glass started, the ministry that he started, the former Cleveland Brown. And actually, when Chuck Colson got out of prison, he started with Bill, too. And then branched off and started Prison Fellowship. And it was there are two different kind of ministries. The Champions for Life ministry is an evangelistic ministry. They go in and have like sports clinics and stuff like that, different entertainers and different speakers to come in on the prison yards. And then we take a large team of volunteers, and they would lead people to the Lord. And the Prison Fellowship is much more directed at Bible studies and stuff like that. So you've got two different arms. It really would have been ideal if they could have worked together, but unfortunately, just like you have McDonald's and Burger King and Chick-fil-A and Wendy's all battling for the fast food dollar, you have ministries fighting for dollars and churches fighting for dollars, and it shouldn't necessarily be like that, but it is.
That's unfortunate. Yeah, really almost sort of the Crockett and McMahon of the prison yard, I guess you would say. But that's kind of unfortunate that there's been that kind of a divide as far as their purpose. But as far as the things that you've got going on today, I know that, again, you very recently got on Twitter, and, of course, the handle being Real Tully B. People can find you at that. Previous to that, for a good period of time, you've been excellent about communicating with your public on Facebook, everything. So what are some of the main things that you've got going on right now that you want people to know about as far as be it your ministry work and other matters that you're involved in?
Well, I think probably one of the biggest things is the fact that I am available to speak. You know, I mean, it's when I was on staff for the prison ministry, you know, I didn't necessarily market myself to churches and organizations to do banquets and fundraising and that kind of stuff. And now that I'm not on staff with the prison ministry thing anymore, it is you've almost got to remarket yourself, you know. And I hate to even call it that, but you if people don't know what you're capable of and what you can do and how you speak and the anointing that God puts on your life, you know, then you never get to go speak anyplace. And then you sit at home. And it's kind of like being in the wrestling business. You know, if you're not out wrestling, you're not getting paid and you're not working. And so it's kind of like that. But it's, you know, there's so many other things. Like this week, I've got to go to Michigan tomorrow and for the Beacon House and play golf in a fundraising golf tournament. And then Sunday night and Monday, I'm going to Columbia, South Carolina to play golf and be at the fundraising tournament for the George Rogers Foundation you know, hang out with a bunch of Heisman Trophy winners. And, you know, there's a lot of different things that go on. I certainly don't, my lifestyle is a lot simpler now that I'm getting a little bit older and kind of set in my ways. My golf score is going down and still travel and speak and still get up every morning and seek the Lord. And now with Facebook and Twitter, you know, I'm putting some little thoughts out every day, or almost every day. Some days I don't feel inspired, so I don't say anything. And you know, I'm not going to be pressured that you know I've got to say something every day. But the things that I have been saying and the feedback that are coming is pretty phenomenal. It's certainly eye opening to me that you know I can type something in my bedroom in San Antonio, Texas, and some lady in Australia sends back, God, I needed that, you know, and then YouTube and stuff like that with my testimony and stuff like that. I'm learning the technology part slowly, that if I was really on top of my game, I'd have all this stuff so slick and a website and all that kind of good stuff. But anyway, it's all good.
The technology's moving fast. Oh, sure. You know, the technology's moving fast, Tully. Even those of us that have been doing this for a while are still in some ways kind of struggling to keep up. It's, you know, you never know what the next great social medium is going to be that gets invented. But it's good to see that you're aggressively taking advantage of it here to get your message out. And, again, I think it's something that, you know, speaking on behalf of all of your fans here, that, again, as great of a career as you had in the ring, I mean, everything that you're trying to do right now, this is real life type stuff, trying to help people's lives and trying to work for the betterment of others. So, again, any of us that were ever a professional admirers of you are even bigger personal admirers, I would say, because of the work that you're doing. And it really is tremendous. We've enjoyed so much getting a chance to talk to you today, Tully, and it'd be our great pleasure if we could do so again in the future. I just want to thank you so much for your time, sir.
Well, it was I'm sorry for the mix-up a little bit earlier.
No problem.
I'd love to be back on the show. Well, we got some time to answer a few other questions. I was told that you know my career better than I do. So, you know, I was a little bit uneasy, not in case I didn't remember something. So,
well, I appreciate the FDH New York Bureau putting me over to that degree. But again, I was somebody that watched it back in the day, 6:05 every Saturday night on TBS, and you know, it was just such great memories of everything back then and everything that you guys got a chance to do. And it's just a magical time. I mean, I'm sure that's the reason that, you know, people are always bringing up those glory days to you when they're talking to you. I mean, it's a magic time that'll probably never be replicated in this business. And again, you were such a big part of it. But again, God bless you, sir, for all the work that you're doing. And we look forward to talking to you in the future.
Okay. Thank you, Rick. Bless you.
Thanks so much. We want to thank Tully Blanchard and thank all of you for tuning in. FDH Lounge, mini episode 142.